Once upon a time, moderates were supported and even rose to power in U.S. politics. President Clinton's centrist views gave him traction to the Oval Office in the early 90s. Fast forward to today, in this time of gridlock and extreme partisanship, and the so-called Common Sense Coalition wants to be a new force in the Senate. Is it possible? We're talking about what can be done to fix the Senate on this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ira Shapiro is an international trade lawyer and former Hill staffer who served 12 years in senior positions in the U.S. Senate, including in the office of former Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson and as an ambassador under President Bill Clinton. He's the author of two books on the Senate. The latest one is called Broken: Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? Ira, welcome to the program.
Kate, so good of you to have me. Thanks so much.
Well, you have intimate knowledge about the inner workings of the Senate, but as you wrote in your notes that you are no longer a Senate insider, that ended 30 years ago. Help us connect the dots on your career path and your connections to the upper chamber of Congress.
I have almost, and this tips my age off, Kate, but I have really almost a 50-year love of the Senate. It was very influential to my growing up, both in high school when I watched the Senate pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was one of the most thrilling accomplishments of in history. And then during the Vietnam War, when I was in college, the Senate was the sense, gave us the sense of hope. They were questioning the Vietnam policy. Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy came from the Senate to challenge President Johnson. Then we had the Watergate experience, where the Senate was started the accountability of Richard Nixon. So the Senate was always a special place, and I was fortunate to get an internship there. It kind of shaped my career. And
this was the 1960s, your internship.
Well, I have to disclose, I'm kind of old, but 1969, first year of Nixon's presidency, I became an intern with Senator Javits, and it convinced me to try to come back to the Senate after I went to graduate school and law school. And I owe it to Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin. I always knew he was a visionary, but he brought me back, and I worked in the Senate 12 years. Fast forward briefly. I left the Senate in 1987. I worked with the Senate in the Clinton administration when I was in the Senate, working in the administration. And then did other things and just watched from the sidelines as the Senate declined.
Watching from the sidelines, in your new book, you look at the first 6 months or so of the Trump presidency. Presidency, you describe that tends to blot out everything else on the political landscape or distort it. So you set up this argument that the Senate worked better when you were there versus how it does today. Can you help us set up a contrast?
Well, I would say that I do make that argument, but I think that argument is sort of universally accepted. In the period of time in the 60s and the 70s, we had what I called in my first book, The Last Great Senate. I've taken to calling it something else now, Mike Mansfield's Senate, because Mansfield was the Senate leader. It was a rare period, looking back, both before and after the Senate was different. And it was a rare period of sort of progressive accomplishments, but a Senate that worked on the basis of trust, mutual respect, bipartisanship, and compromise, all things that have been lost over time. So the one thing now, if we come to today, Senate, Kate, the one thing everyone agrees on, they can't stop talking about it, is that the Senate's broken. The senators feel it as much as the public feels it. And so my book attempts to trace what happened and kind of names names along the way, trying, rather than just sort of throw up our hands and say it's broken, who did it, who still distinguishes themselves, How do you rebuild the Senate? And with the overlying thought, overriding thought, that the Senate is the crucial balance wheel in our system. When the Senate fails, the system seizes up, and that's what we've been seeing for a long time.
Ira Shapiro is with us. His new book is Broken, Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? You can ask a question, join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Which moments in recent Senate history stick out to you as being particularly good or bad for the nation? How would you rate the performance of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ira, you praised Mitch McConnell for his early days as majority leader, but then you have also said in your book that he has played his own part in driving the country to the fiscal cliff. I'm not exactly sure what do you see as Mitch McConnell doing well and not so well?
Well, Kate, you've actually hit on a central theme of my book, and something I'm going to be talking about a lot in book events, including starting on Monday at Brookings Institution. I believe that Mitch McConnell is the most powerful Senate leader that we've ever had. The arguments that Steve Bannon and the right wing make about McConnell being weak or ineffective are laughable arguments. If you measure power in terms of the ability to accomplish your objectives and prevent your opponents from accomplishing theirs, there's no one that's ever been more powerful than Mitch McConnell. Unfortunately, the power he has exercised is power as a Republican leader, a partisan leader, not a Senate leader, not a Senate leader trying to make the Senate work. I think Senator McConnell's effect on the Senate and on the country has been overall catastrophic. What you do say, and you started your question, and it's correct. You made the point that I praise him for certain things, and I do. I praised him for something he did in 2008 when he was a new leader. He helped. Really played an important role in dealing with the financial crisis that threatened to take our entire economy into the second depression. But what I go on to say after that is 90 days later, when the economy was still in desperate trouble, he strongly opposed anything to help it recover simply because the president had changed. McConnell is the ultimate partisan. He puts party before country. And his record in the last decade, I think, parallels the decline of the Senate. And I'll add one more thing, because this is when I talk about the Senate, it's dangerous if I start filibustering.
Nice.
Yeah. But this is the thing. If you think about the Senate's long decline, and I mean long decline, it has sort of a graph from starting in 80, but more in the late 80s, the early 90s, it starts declining in sort of a gradual way. It's no longer able to overcome the forces of polarization and partisanship. So the gradual decline goes on. And then all of a sudden, about 2009... the gradual decline becomes a very steep decline. The trajectory goes almost straight down. That coincides with McConnell's period in leadership, and it's no coincidence.
How much more difficult is McConnell's job with President Trump occupying the White House?
Well, McConnell is proven to be a very effective at pursuing his goals. When President Obama was in the White House, McConnell was the leading obstructionist. he tried and succeeded oftentimes in paralyzing Obama's program. With President Trump in the White House and McConnell as still the majority leader, the situation changes. Now he uses his power to steamroll the minority. So the one constant with Senator McConnell in the minority and in the majority is abuse of power.
We're understanding the Senate's inability to overcome partisanship and what led to the decline with Ira Shapiro. His new book is Broken: Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Do you think the Senate should shoulder the blame for the gridlock we're seeing on the Hill? Do you think the Senate is fixable as a political body? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll return to the conversation after a news update. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about how to find common ground in the Senate. Democrat Tom Daschle spent 18 years in the U.S. Senate, with a few terms in the House before that. In 2013, the former majority leader talked about his start in politics. He emphasized the importance of listening to people.
A practice that I started when I was very early into my career as a member of the United States Senate was to drive to every one of the 66 counties of South Dakota in an unscheduled way throughout the year. I'd get in the car by myself and just show up and talk to people, reflecting on their challenges, their aspirations, their criticisms, and yes, their hopes.
What a stark contrast to Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton's office that has been criticized in recent days for his office's practice of sending cease and desist letters to some constituents who have called in. Ira Shapiro is an international trade lawyer, former Hill staffer who served a dozen years in senior positions in the U.S. Senate. His new book is called Broken. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What moments in recent Senate history stick out to you as being particularly good or bad for the nation? Join in the conversation or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ira, going back to that Tom Daschle speech, getting into a car alone and just going out in the country, in South Dakota, showing up unannounced, we don't hear of that going on today. Town halls are tightly controlled.
No, it's certainly a big change. I'm somewhat biased because Tom Daschle is an old friend, because we started in the Senate together as staffers in the late 70s. And we recently got together for a one-hour interview on C-SPAN TV, which will air in a couple of weeks. Those kind of things don't happen as much anymore. But the truth is, senators really do still understand their constituents, actually. That's the amazing thing. They do it through their coming to the states, and they do it, they're constantly in touch. That, I believe, is actually not the problem. I believe the problem is that despite their knowledge of the diverse interests that they represent, they get back to the Senate and they end up as partisans. They are lining up behind their leaders. That's what's happened in recent years, and that's been exacerbated under McConnell and his predecessor, Schumer's predecessor, Harry Reid. So that has been happening. And the hard thing to convey, Kate, is, number one, they know better. And number two, they are basically disgusted with the institution that they're in. They can't stop talking about how frustrated they are with the Senate. And my sympathy for them is limited because they're not helpless victims. They ought to change it if they don't like it.
But when they form voting blocks, for instance,
yes,
the Common Sense Coalition, 25 members there,
yes,
helped get out of the juggernaut of the government shutdown, what do you make of when they start forming groups? Is that good or bad?
Well, I think that in the current context, I think those groups are good. And the reason I say that, and I'll come back to the Common Sense Coalition for a moment, the groups are good because what's happened in the Senate is an evolution of what I call the leader-driven Senate. That is, the committees do their work, but ultimately it doesn't matter because the leaders line everybody up. One of the senators, and they vote with their team. One of the senators, Michael Bennett of Colorado, told me in 2012, we don't do any legislating. We just wait to be told by Senator Reid or Senator McConnell what the team is doing. So the Common Sense Coalition and other smaller gangs, they're called, you know, Gang of Six, Gang of Eight, those people come together saying, we shouldn't be lining up in these partisan ways. This isn't the way the Senate works or should work. And so the Common Sense Coalition, I think, represents a continuation of that. And it's led, not coincidentally, by Susan Collins, who's always doing things like that because she's a throwback to the way the Senate used to work.
Because she's almost found herself in a centrist position as the party drifts to the right or not?
Well, drift is a word I would contest. I'd say the party has lurched to the right, and it's lurched in many stages. Whenever you think it can't go any further right, it goes further right. Susan is the last basic moderate independent Republican. Then she's joined by Joe Manchin, who is a very accomplished person, but a moderate to conservative Democrat. And they broadened out the group. Now, all they did, and I commend them for it, was ending the short government shutdown. But the question does become, can they hold together? Can they provide the kind of counterweight that says to the leaders, we're not going along with this tribal politics that are infecting us? They can have power, so I'm encouraged by what they're trying to do.
Let's go to the phones now with Sylvia, who's joining us from Clear Lake. Hi, Sylvia.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Mr. Shapiro, in your view, how has campaign financing contributed to the decline in the Senate?
Well, first, Sylvia, I can't thank you for the question, and I can't say anything to a person from Clear Lake without saying that the greatest Clear Lake person was Gaylord Nelson, who started me in my Senate career. So I think money in politics is having a terrible effect in a couple of ways. Number one, the senators spend too much time having to raise the money to run again, to get back to the institution that they then say doesn't work. Number two, the moneyed interests do have too much of an effect, and particularly in the Republican Party and the money interests led by what I would call the Koch brothers network. Having said that, and it's not a great system, it's a terrible system, and we've got to change it, and yet you still see many members who function the way real senators did. You see, whether it's Susan Collins or Lamar Alexander on the Republican side or Patty Murray or any number of the Democrats, they know how to do the work. They're not overly indebted to the money, but they're trapped in the increasingly partisan, leader-driven Senate, and that's what I think they have to break through.
But it takes so much more money these days to get to a position of power, to get to the upper chamber.
It does. It takes a lot of money. But you see candidates on both sides. I mean, look, it's a terrible escalating arms race. and I hate the system, but you do see candidates on both sides able to raise the money and able to compete. You also see the healthy alternative, the extraordinary alternative, possibly, that Bernie Sanders brought to the 2016 campaign, where people actually can raise small amounts of money. People at in every state, the people that are energized can play a role in campaigns. So the people with the money don't always win, which is a good thing.
Let's pause right there. Let's bring in Jeremy in Racine. Hi, Jeremy. Jeremy, are you there?
I'm here. Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Good morning.
Okay. Good morning. Over the decades, I've noticed a big trend, huge trend in bigger money in politics. And anytime a politician needs to have their hands in the party line's coffers, they will tote their line. Even though there's majority, a lot of them are moderates, they're willing to work across the aisle. But if you take their money, you have to tote their line. And that's becoming a huge problem in all of Congress to get things done, because they are always looking towards their next election bid. So they have to make sure they make friends with the right people so they keep getting the money they need to stay reelected. And that's a huge problem. And I'm glad you brought up Bernie Sanders, because I believe that is going to be a huge contributing factor in upcoming elections on how money is going to be handled through candidates. I hope it really takes off from there.
Jeremy, thanks. Your reaction, Ira?
Well, I agree with what Jeremy says. I think people are spending both too much time looking for the money and then being more indebted to the debtor, to the donor class. I think that's a particular problem in the Republican Party because of the huge impact of the Koch brothers network. And it's a problem because the banks have too much power, and that the banks, by the way, contribute too much money to both parties. So I agree with him, and I think that Senator Sanders, who said we needed an American revolution in politics, actually produced a potential revolution by raising the money the way he did. But nothing really substitutes for energized people all over the country getting out, organizing, and getting votes and casting their votes.
Let's go to Todd in Janesville along those lines. Hi, Todd.
Hi, good morning. I'm curious on Mr. Shapiro's opinion on the example of the Wisconsin presidential primaries. The Democrats showed up and spoke out that they wanted to see Mr. Sanders, and our Senator Baldwin put her superdelegate votes instead for Hillary Clinton. What is Mr. Shapiro's opinion on why this happens, and did that happen a lot elsewhere in the country?
That's a good question. Look, I think it was the most extraordinary and shocking election, perhaps, of our ever. Donald Trump's victory was a shocking victory. I think that Hillary Clinton, who I supported, Hillary, and I know from the Clinton administration, I think Mrs. Clinton was the wrong candidate at this particular point in time for a variety of reasons, it turns out, namely that being a status quo, perceived as a status quo candidate, you know, third term for Obama, and in fact, maybe a fifth term candidate, two Clinton terms, two Obama terms, it just didn't work. The country wanted something different, by a very narrow margin, of course, and Donald Trump didn't win the popular vote. But I do think that the question that you're asking is an important one. In fairness, and I don't, by the way, when I say in fairness, the DNC didn't handle the campaign correctly. But the superdelegates who supported Mrs. Clinton, in some ways, she earned that support because of how long she has been a Democrat, how many people she worked for all over the country, how she served both in the White House with her husband, but also in the Senate as a Democrat, as Secretary of State for Obama. Bernie Sanders ran an extraordinary campaign, but he was an independent until he became a Democrat for this campaign. So it's complicated. I don't mean to talk too long about it, but Hillary Clinton earned support from a lot of people. She didn't run a very good campaign, and, you know, we're paying the price for that, but it was complicated.
Ira Shapiro, you write about the health care legislation and saying that it hit a new low for the Senate last year's debate over health care. What was so particularly ugly about the way that was handled?
Well, I do think it hit a new low. I think it was an unprecedented abuse of the Senate. And I think it signaled the dangers of Senator McConnell continuing as leader in the Senate and in the majority. Look, I was in the Senate for a long time, and I've studied it for a long time. You can't, Kate, you can't find an example of major legislation that was written in that way, without hearings, without committee consideration, without amendments, an attempt to ram it through before people understood what was in it, taking away the health care, potentially the health insurance of millions and millions of people, destabilizing the whole system. Even the Republicans, you heard it from only a few of them, ended up opposing it. They went along with their leader, but 10, 12, 15 Republicans were quoted in the newspapers talking about this is a terrible process. So it was a new low. I would never have envisioned it could be done. I predicted in the book it wouldn't work. Ultimately, McConnell was stymied on that effort, and yet he turns around and manages to make serious changes in the tax bill. So I think it was an abuse of process of the type we've never seen before.
Let's spend a minute here on Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. Is
sure.
he an effective leader?
I think he's a new leader, and I think he's an improvement over his predecessor, Harry Reid. I think Schumer's a capable politician. He came in, let's remember that nobody ever became a leader under more unusual circumstances. Hillary Clinton loses unexpectedly, and the Democratic anger across the country at the election result, but also at the way Mr. Trump conducted the transition. So Schumer's thrown into the fray right away. I think he's done a respectable job. There are mistakes I believe he's made, but, you know, I think he's a good leader. What the Senate really need, and I called for it 5 years in my first book in 2012, the Senate desperately needed new leaders.
And let's pause right there. We are exploring how to fix the Senate with a veteran insider of the upper chamber, Ira Shapiro. He is a former Hill staffer who served a dozen years in senior positions in the Senate. His new book is Broken. You can offer your insights on how to fix the Senate at 800-642-1234. Is the so-called Common Sense Coalition a way forward? Do you think senators should build more groups and coalitions or voting blocks in the Senate? Join in, tweet us at WPR Mornings, back after this news. Many Democratic lawmakers dressed in black and refused to stand to greet President Trump in his first State of the Union address Tuesday. That set a tone And we're talking about tone in the Senate on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In December of 2007, Trent Lott gave his final speech on the floor as U.S. Senator, surrounded by the chamber's wooden desks and standing on the royal blue carpet. The Republican from Mississippi complimented fellow lawmakers. Then he offered this to his colleagues.
Disagree if you have to, but don't be disagreeable. There has become a sort of a meanness sometime that I don't think is befitting of the institution, and I hope we will find a way to stay away from that.
How poignant as we ruminate on how the Senate got to this point and how to turn the ship around. Ira Shapiro stays with us. His new book is Broken. Can the Senate save itself and the country? And you can respond at 800-642-1234. Who can you point to in the Senate who has been especially instructive to the body's success or to the body's failure? Let's ponder this through history and in recent times. Get your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Terry, who's been waiting in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Yeah, great guest, great show. What I wanted to check out, or if I heard that right, that kind of an unwritten rule where senators don't campaign against other senators when they're up for election, which I think has changed. I think I heard it changed the last two or three election cycles. So I'd like to have your guest comment about that.
It's a great question, Terry, and I think it is an important change. Senators didn't used to campaign against each other. In fact, quietly, they would sort of pull for their client, their colleagues to win because they were friends, even if they were in the other party. In 2004, Senator Bill Frist, the new Republican leader, decided to campaign against Tom Daschle, who was the Democratic leader. He went to South Dakota and campaigned against Daschle. That was a new thing, and it was a symbol of a politics that was breaking down. And that kind of, you know, those things don't determine everything, but they're important. I criticized Chuck Schumer recently on a different matter. When Schumer became the Democratic leader, shortly thereafter, Senator McConnell's wife, Elaine Chao, was nominated by President Trump to be Secretary of Transportation. Elaine Chao is eminently qualified. She had been Deputy Secretary of Transportation, and she'd been Secretary of Labor. Most qualified person in the cabinet of Trump, other than perhaps Secretary Mattis. Schumer votes against her. 93-5 vote, and the leader is one of the five against her. So what's he thinking at that point? What the old Senate would have done, the old Senate, somebody, Chuck Schumer, would have gone over to Mitch McConnell and said, congratulations on Elaine's nomination. Why don't the four of us go out to dinner? So there's been clearly a breakdown of the ability of those people to relate to each other. What Susan Collins, Joe Manchin, and others are trying to do is rebuild that. And to some extent, it already happens in the committees when they sit down and deal with real problems. But when it gets to the point of the leaders, then they just sort of go off in their partisan directions.
Terry, thanks for the call. Ira, you wrote that the last effective leadership team was Democrat Tom Daschle and Republican Trent Lott in the early 2000s.
They were a team.
And we heard there in the open Trent Lott saying in his farewell about, you know, disagree, but don't be disagreeable. Do you think that is what worked on that team?
Thanks for giving me the chance, Kate, because Senator Lott is a very interesting person. I wrote in the epilogue of my first book that I wasn't complimentary of Senator Lott. And somebody said to me, well, you're pretty hard on Trent Lott. I said, well, my source was his memoir. Trent Lott who came from the House, hated the Senate when he first got there. He really hated it, and he said so. And he determined he wanted to change it. And he rose to the leadership ladder and became a leader. But when he became a leader, he started to grow. And he became a better leader. And he led because Tom Daschle and he, political opposites, formed a good relationship. There's a section in my book that explains or describes how Daschle and Lott working together helped us through the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton. They were the last team that worked together, and they still work together. They write books together. They speak together. But Lott had to grow. The interesting thing, Senate leaders often grow in office. And then there's the Senate, current Senate leader, Senator McConnell, who has not grown. He has shrunk over time to utter partisanship and a dangerous abuse of the rules.
Randy from Madison called in, couldn't stay with us. He asked, what does it say then that Senator McConnell didn't take up President Obama's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court? That wasn't a fair shake. Explore that for a moment. Judge Merrick Garland, who was chosen at the time to replace the late Antonin Scalia.
It's chapter one of my book, because I regard it as a very pivotal moment. It was an unprecedented power play by McConnell. But the reason I made it chapter one of my book is that it came at a time when McConnell had just become the Senate Majority Leader. And the Senate, in 2015, started to work effectively. The obstructionist, McConnell, had become a constructive player. One person switching, and the Senate worked respectably until Justice Scalia died. And McConnell puts blocking the next Senate, the Obama nominee, he puts that above the work of the Senate. He sacrifices the Senate for his partisan reasons. He poisons the Senate yet again. So it's a very, very important, and it poisoned the whole discussion about Neil Gorsuch. And if we have, as we're going to have at some future point, the next Supreme Court appointee, that will be an utter war in the Senate. I have an answer to how to fix it, but that will be a major war.
How do you fix it then?
I fix it actually by things like the members, for instance, of the Common Sense Coalition, who go to the president and say, if there was a vacancy, and say, Mr. President, you have to nominate somebody who will get 60 or even 65 votes, a moderate, for this swing vote on the court. And the president won't like it, and Attorney General Sessions will say, we don't have to do that. We can get him through with 51 votes. And I have these other senators say, no, it won't work, because if you don't give us somebody who's a moderate, you won't get 51 votes. You'll get 43 votes. They have power. They can do things. They don't have to go along with a nominee who would be extreme at a time when the Supreme Court is just so evenly divided.
Let's go to Ray in Manitowoc. Hi, Ray.
I'll attempt to be very brief, in all due respect to
unlike me,
who's connecting dots beautifully. The one thing I will say about fixing the Senate, the House, and all the state houses is ultimately it's the voters' responsibility. My generation has allowed itself to be manipulated, and we don't pay attention. We are the ones that have turned our politics into more of a fanatical act and a team sport. We punish the politicians who understand a healthy democracy is about the spirit of compromise. I'll just finish off with three senator names that are good examples to me: John McCain, Russ Feingold, who took a beating, and Bernie Sanders, of course. These are the types of politicians, left or right or independent, that we as citizens should be supporting, not the wedge issue demagogues.
Ray, thank you so much for the call and for helping us bring closure to the conversation. Ira,
great
go ahead.
Statement. No, look, I think it's a great statement. It's just a great statement. And one of the things that I'm hopeful for, and here's one image I sometimes think about. The crisis in our democracy certainly didn't start when Donald Trump decided to run for president. Our democracy is a little bit like the proverbial frog in the boiling water, slowly dying without noticing it. President Trump's election changes that. People notice where we are now. People are energized. People want to save and restore the democracy. And I'm hoping that the kind of excitement that we've seen in some of the elections so far, such as Virginia and in Alabama with Doug Jones' victory, if people turn out, people are energized, that's the ultimate check and the ultimate cure.
Well, Ira, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Kate, it's great to have an interview like this and the time to just talk. So thank you.
Ira Shapiro is an international trade lawyer and former Hill staffer who served a dozen years in senior positions in the U.S. Senate, including in the office of former Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson, who he tipped his hat to earlier on in the program. He was also an ambassador under President Clinton. He's author of two books on the Senate. The latest one is called Broken: Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? This hour of the morning show was produced by Bill Martins, Brianne Shasso, and Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network.